So this is a short series during a time of year where we feel and experience and think about darkness as we are in the weeks approaching Tisha B'Av. And so for many of us, we think about historical periods that involve darkness, and obviously the most recent, the most difficult, of course, is the Holocaust. And yet, in these times of darkness, there have always been lights. And our goal is to focus on just a few of those incredible, brilliant lights who illuminated the Jewish world during this most dark period. So there could be many weeks, dozens, scores, hundreds of personalities. But time is short, so we're going to select four. And tonight we're going to focus on the Kloisenberger Rebbe, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, Rav Yekusiel Yehuda Halberstam. And each of these people, and the Kloisenberger, of course, chief among them, they're difficult for regular, ordinary people like us to grasp in any way. You know, the scope, the magnitude of his achievements, what he did, but who he was, is impossible to fathom for a regular, ordinary person. But we will aspire in a few brief moments to fulfill the traditional dictum of Masai Yagiu Masai L'Masai Avosai. A person should ask themselves, when will my actions, Yagiu literally means, Lahagia means to arrive, but there's a tradition that it is Masai Yagiu. Lahagia also means, Lagas means to touch. So we will never arrive. I shouldn't speak about anybody else, but I don't think anybody that we know can arrive at the level of the Kloisenberger. But Lagas, to reach out to touch just the edge of the greatness of the Kloisenberger, that we probably can do. So it's kedai to take a few moments to understand what the Kloisenberger might mean to us. Now, this is not meant to be a scholarly biographical presentation. There are several works on your bibliography that will be helpful if you want to read more about the Kloisenberger that you have in front of you. Most of these volumes are accessible in English, and we'll talk about some of them. So if you want a formal biographical sketch, you'll find that more in the text. If we were to distill one, and what seemed to me a chief operating principle that drove the Kloisenberger through his entire life, it would be the charge of being passionate. That would be the theme. That would be the motif. Be passionate. Be passionate about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Ribono Shel Olam. Be passionate about Torah. Be passionate about mitzvos. Be on fire. This was a man who was on fire. And because he was so passionate, he was able to develop himself and develop the world around him in unbelievable ways. You know, in the late 1950s, his passion enabled him to build an entire community with every imaginable institution. In the 1950s, the Kloisenberger fulfilled one of his life dreams, and he moved to Israel. As many of you know, he moved to Netanya, and he established there a network of schools, of chadarim, of girls' schools, of shuls, of yeshivas, and ultimately, as many of you know, the Lanyado Hospital. It was all him. He built everything. He built, if I'm not mistaken, according to my research, a hospital that was founded in 1975 that has never had a shvitah. There's never been a strike at Lanyado Hospital. Because that was how it was built. That was the type of tzura. So how does a man who suffered so much and had so much taken away from him, and was so broken, and yet, in his 50s, move to a new country and build a set of world-class institutions, a whole new community. How did he do that? Because he was passionate. And it was the same passion that drove him to build institutions in a place that you couldn't really imagine that institutions would exist. And this was the network of DP camps that the Rebbe visited after the war. He was primarily in a place, probably most famously, in a place called Forenwald, which was a significant size DP camp, and he founded something called She'eris HaPleita, which he described in a letter, which there is a collection of his letters published in several volumes called Shefa Chaim, which are accessible through an amazing resource called Otzar HaChachma, where he describes, he says, the point of my vision for Shefa, for She'eris HaPleita is that it should be what we would call today a multidisciplinary approach, where it would service any possible need for these Jews who survived the war, and therefore they're going to support any institution that's going to fall under that rubric. So in that context of this letter, he's talking about the Agudas Yisrael, and he says that the She'eris HaPleita, it can't be owned by, under the auspices of Agudas Yisrael, because it's supposed to be independent. It's supposed to be this network, but it's going to support Agudas Yisrael institutions in the DP camps. Because he envisioned a full-service institution that had religious schools, both for boys and for girls, and vocational training, so that people should have something with which they could build their lives. A man who had lost everything was able to envision and build something from nothing, everything from nothing, in the DP camps. The Kloisenberger was born in 1905 and already was recognized as a prodigy, as a young person. He was a descendant of the Sanzer dynasty, and he became known as the Sanz Kloisenberger Rebbe because as a young man he became the Rav of one of the major kihilos in Kloisenberg, which was the capital of Romania, which is, you know, every 5 minutes it's Hungary, it's Romania, whatever it is. But he attracted many followers and was recognized as one of the stars in the world of Eastern European Hasidic Jewry. Now, before he was 40 years old, the entire world collapsed on him. First, he was taken to a work detail. Then he ended up hiding in Budapest before he was picked up. Just one historical note, if you recall, the Germans, the Nazis, they did not extend their deathly reach into Hungary until 1944. Until then, Jews lived with some measure of relative safety, you could say, at the hands of the anti-Semitic Hungarians, who maybe harassed them and abused them, but didn't deport them. That took place in 1944. So at the beginning of the war, the Rebbe was first sent to a place, a work camp, then he was hiding. At that time, the Rebbe had a wife and 11 children. During this period of his relocation, at some point, it's not clear exactly what day, his wife and 10 of his children were picked up and they were sent away. He had an 11th son who actually, this is hard to imagine, his 11th son survived the war but died just after liberation, before the Rebbe could see him. So by the time that the war is over, he had lost his wife and 11 children. They were all gone. The first 10 were gone with his wife, and then the last one passed away just thereafter. He spent several months in a well-known death camp in Auschwitz, which was the fate of the vast majority of Hungarian Jews, because that's where they went straight. The Germans started deporting them straight to Auschwitz. But the Rebbe was actually sent from Auschwitz to a work detail, which was highly unusual to be able to enter those gates and to leave. Where was he sent? He was actually sent to Warsaw. What was he doing in Warsaw? He was with a slave labor detail that was cleaning up the Warsaw ghetto. Because if you remember, the spring of 1943, the Warsaw Ghetto had been razed by the Germans during and after the uprising. So there was actually a group of laborers who were taken from Auschwitz to the Warsaw Ghetto, and the Rebbe was one of them. After that, he was taken to a place called the Mulldorf Forest, where he did also excruciating slave labor. He was on a death march, and ultimately he was liberated. Upon liberation, he set out to build. How did he get that strength? I don't know. I can't tell you. But he was mamish on fire. He was mamish on fire. So he was going to build whatever institutions were necessary. And he viewed that as his mission. Many of you are familiar with a great Talmud Chacham who wrote over 30 amazing svarim. His name is Rav Asher Weiss Shlita. Rav Asher Zelig Weiss, he is a Rav and a Dayan and a Moritz Tzedek, a tremendous Talmud Chacham in Yerushalayim. He lives in Ramot. His shul is in Ramot. He was the speaker, if you were there, at the Chicago Siyum HaShas. I don't know what was going on in MetLife Stadium, because Lamaisa, we had Rav Asher Weiss here in Chicago. So Rav Asher Weiss described how his father, although his father was not, his father, Rav Moshe Weiss, Zichron Levracha, was not formally a Kloisenberger Chassid, his father arrived at Auschwitz Shavuos and switched barracks with a guy in the next door barrack so that he could be with the Kloisenberger. It's a whole unbelievable, crazy story about how the guy next door to him had a son who was in his barrack. So to unite them, he said, I'll switch with you. I'll become you and you'll become him. And he spent the war years, he spent those months together with the Kloisenberger. He stayed with him through till the DP camp. And the Kloisenberger was involved in many things in the DP camps. One of them was dealing with the Niftarim, the people who had passed on, and burial, all this. So Rav Moshe Weiss, at one point, couldn't take it anymore. Couldn't take it. So he said to the Kloisenberger, we can't go on like this. The Kloisenberger said, You think this is Mesiris Nefesh? This is not Mesiris Nefesh. That was Mesiris Nefesh before. This is Mesiris Haguf. That's what the Kloisenberger told him. So he tells over this Maisa. Rosh Weiss tells over this whole Maisa. And then Rav Moshe Weiss said, Rebbe, I'll help you, but I'll ask you for a bracha. So what was the bracha? He asked where he said that all my children should become Talmidei Chachamim. P.S., he ended up getting married, moving to New York, moving to Israel. A whole long story about how he became, originally he was a pauper. Rav Moshe Weiss, when he lived in New York, he was a Malabin, he was very terribly poor, impoverished. But he came to Israel, he became a very successful Kablan, building huge developments in Kiryat Sanz, in Netanya. And he had seven sons, who are all huge Talmidei Chachamim, Mechaber Sfarim, Rosh Yeshivas, Gaonim. He says, obviously, it was because the Kloisenberger blessed him after the war, that he was willing to be the Kloisenberger's right-hand man to build these mostos. So where did the Kloisenberger get it from? He was on fire. I don't know. I don't know how else to say it. He was just passionate. So he's building mostos, but he's also building homes. It's not just that the Rebbe was an institutional architect, which of course he was, an unbelievable institutional architect, but he was also the builder of people's homes. There's a whole section in this book called Hidden in Thunder by Esther Farbstein. It's her translation of the original Hebrew word called Beseser Ra'am, where she talks about spiritual life in the Holocaust, perspectives on faith, halacha, and leadership during the Holocaust. So she has a section here after the war in the DP camps about weddings. Weddings. And she describes how the Kloisenberger took a special personal interest in the survivors' marriages. That he was Mesader Kedushin for weddings. He was Malave Chasanim. These men who were getting married, they had no parents. They had no father to walk them down. So the Rebbe walked them down. Not only that, she says, that he, for the girls who had no parents, he personally taught them kala classes. Because he said, I'm the father of the bride. I'm going to take responsibility to make sure she should have kala classes. Unbelievable. He was making sure that they had nice shiduchim. In the middle of everything else that he was building homes. He was building lives. He would, it describes how at the weddings he would dance mitzvah dances. And then, of course, because he was such a visionary, he founded Gemachs and Hachnasas Kala Fund so that they could help the expenses for weddings, and a gemach that they should have wedding dresses. Amazing. I don't know, absolutely amazing. By the way, just a parenthetical footnote, and then we'll move on. He also had a special fund for girls who would cover their hair and imported wigs for Sheitlich. The JDC apparently started, based on his request, importing natural hair from Italy so that they could make their own handmade Sheitels. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. He was passionate about mitzvos. Unbelievably passionate about mitzvos. To describe, it's hard to imagine. Some of you are familiar that in September of 1945, the foreign-walled DP camp had a very hush of a visitor. Some of you heard of him. His nickname was Ike. You've heard of him. So the Supreme Allied Commander, Dwight Eisenhower, made a visit to Foreign-Walled. You could take a look on YouTube, if you Google it, put in the date in September. I actually found out, and I bought, it wasn't a lot of money, because I didn't get the original archive. I got the one that says, like, the watermark on it. The other one was, like, $500. The watermark is okay, but I can send it to you afterwards if you want. There is a video of little Jewish children dressed properly with little flags, like a silent film, waving, watching as General Eisenhower arrives in the DP camp. All these children are there, and he's going into one building after the next building. The last frame in this video, he goes into a building that has like a marquee on the top of the doorway. It says Base Tefillah. That's the visit. There was a book by a man, passed away already. His name was Meyer Birnbaum. Meyer Birnbaum wrote a book called Lieutenant Birnbaum. Some of you may have heard of this book. And he was, for a period of time, the Jewish attaché for Eisenhower, because he knew Yiddish and he translated for him. So he has a whole description of how, when Eisenhauer came to Foreign-Walled, who did he meet with? The Kloisenberger. So first, when the Kloisenberger was there, Eisenhower came, but he was in the middle of davening. It was Yom Kippur, so he couldn't talk. Afterwards, he goes to meet with Eisenhower. He puts on a talus and he starts crying. Meyer Birnbaum has to translate for him. Eisenhower is very moved by this man who's like overcome with emotion. What does he ask for? What does the Kloisenberger ask for Eisenhower for? Because Eisenhower says, what can we do? Help this man. What can you get for him? So when is it? Remember, when is this visit? Yom Kippur. So what does he ask for? That's right. He asked for Dalad Minim. So Eisenhower says that they're going to get, and they did, an Allied plane that flew to Italy to bring Dalad Minim to the DP camp. Kachava. Kachava. Because what did he care about? What did he dream about? What was he passionate about? He was passionate about mitzvos. Mitzvos. So they should have Dalad Minim. So they did. Which, by the way, was a big deal even before the war. Because in many Northern European communities, especially Shtetlach, they couldn't get these kind of fruits and branches. They got them from Italy. They got them imported. They were going to have them in the DP camp because of the Rebbe. This is the English translation of the Hebrew biography of the Rebbe. In Hebrew, it was called Lapid Ha'esh, the torch of fire, which is maybe how I got this theme, that the Rebbe was on fire. It was translated into English called The Kloisenberger Rebbe. It's in two volumes. What they write in this book is not to be believed. a normal person, you cannot believe what is written in this book. It is impossible. But the Kloisenberger did the impossible. The Kloisenberger never ate treif food. Never ate treif food. Not in slave labor, not in Auschwitz, not in the Moldau Forest. He never ate treif food. How that is, it's impossible. But he did it. He describes that he generally was very machmir on other people that they have to eat. But for himself, he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it. He insisted that everybody else would eat, but he wouldn't do it. Ad kedei kach, that it describes in the book, that he never ate bishul akum. In the beginning, it says that he used to drink milk, even though the milk wasn't supervised, but it was very unlikely that it was going to be. And then he stopped doing that too. Why? Because at one point, he had drank this unsupervised milk, so it wasn't technically Chalof Yisrael. And he started to, shortly thereafter, he started to swell. And he saw that people were murmuring about him that, you know, that was going to be the end. So he said to himself, you know, if I'm going to die anyway, why should I be eating unsupervised milk? I should only drink Chalof Yisrael. And he said, the next day, his swelling started to go down. So he said, from then on, he never drank the unsupervised milk. Could you imagine? Unbelievable. It describes that he would walk around on Shabbos afternoon begging people in Auschwitz if they had an onion scrap. So there was once a guy who saved a little scrap of onion and gave it to the rabbi. And he was overjoyed. He was thrilled. Why was he thrilled about the scrap of onion? Because he had a minig in Kloisenberg before that he always used to eat at Chalashuris. He used to have a special dish with onion. So what was he worried about in Auschwitz? That he should have his Chalashuris onion. It describes that every Shabbos afternoon he did not miss a Shalashuris of Divrei Torah. Because he loved mitzvahs. How could he go a Shalashuris without Divrei Torah? So it describes that he would say his Shtikl Torah to himself. He might sit in the corner and say over his little Shalashuris drasha to himself. Because the Torah needs to be said, because the Shalashuris needs to be experienced. Because that's what He was living for that. That one of the letters in the collection has a description afterwards about in the DP camp making sure they're going to arrange kosher lePesach oil. It's one thing you get matzahs, okay, but every detail, because the mitzvah's miloshon tzavsa about connects us to the Ribbono Shalom, and he loved that. He was so passionate about that. It's unbelievable. So when I said at the beginning, when can we ever reach this level? Can anybody ever imagine reaching such a level? But maybe we can appreciate a little more our own connection to mitzvahs, our own observance of kashrus, or the way that we observe Shabbos. It's just unbelievable. The Rebbe was unbelievably passionate about helping people. And I wonder if this stemmed from his understanding of his own identity as a chassid. You know, it was an article of the Tzanzer, of the Heiliger Chaim Tzanzer. These are great rabbinic traditions in the path of Hasidim. What does it mean to be a Chassid? If you were to ask the Kloisenberger, how would he define what is a Chassid? So he did that for us. You have it in front of you. Baruch Hashem, this week, Parshas Korach. So we have a Shtikl Torah from the Kloisenberger. That's one of the things we're going to try to do each of these weeks, is not just tell Maislach are very good, but also to tell Shtikl Torah. So in the posthumously published, very, very voluminous collection of his Sichos on the Parsha, we have this piece, which the Kloisenberger said over, you see when it is, at Shalashuris, Parshas Korach, Tovshin Mem Gimel, 1983. So this is almost 40 years ago. I'm assuming this was in Netanya, in Kiryat Sanz. So he quotes at the beginning a Gemara in Sanhedrin, where the Gemara quotes, Vayikach Korach Omer Shlokish Shalokach Mekach Roli Atzmo, Korach Shenasa Korcha B'Yisrael, Ben Yitzhar Sher Siach Kol Olam Katzor. The Gemara says, you see, you don't want to even translate these things, how terrible it was what Korach did. He tore the Jewish people apart. He took for himself. He was being very selfish. He literally boiled up the whole world. How terrible it is. Nebuch, the machlokas of Korach. Why does the Gemara emphasize this? Asked the Rebbe. Says the Kloisenberger, V'nira Shamachuven, second paragraph, it's L'lamdenu Gnus Midas HaMachlokas. It's to teach us the terrible, damaging consequences of machlokas, of dispute and disharmony. That nothing good comes from machlokas. That's what we want to learn, says the Kloisenberger for this. He says, you know why it doesn't say, quotes from a medrash, you know why it doesn't say ki tov on Monday? There's some people, I don't know if you ever heard of this, some people have a minhag, they get married on Tuesdays. Why? Because it says ki tov twice. They don't like to say this, but some people don't want to get married on Mondays. Why not? Maybe because it doesn't say ki tov at all. Why does it not say ki tov on Monday? Because Monday, says the Gemara, is the time that we experienced pirud. Monday is Yom Sheni. The first day was Echad. Everything was oneness. That's how HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Kulo Echad. What happens on Monday? Sheni. There's one and then there's another. That's called Machlokas. That's perhaps why the Gemara says Gehenna was created on Monday. Anytime you have a lack of Ichud, of godliness, that's Gehenna. So it's not Ki Tov because of Machlokas. So now comes the Rebbe, and he says, the whole point of the Bria, therefore, is that we should have Echad, and that people should get along with each other. There should be Shalom and Reus. And he says, that is why the Chassidim are called Chassidim. Who knew? Why? Go down. You see the first word of the line is Brachos Dalet Amud Aleph. You could tell how this is actually a Xerox of the original mimeograph sheets that they probably handed out that week in Sanz from the Rebbe's Sicha, his Shmuz. Kach Omar David Lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shel Olam, Lo Chasid Ani. Am I not a chasid? Shekol Malchei Mizrach Umarav Yoshem Agudus Agudus Bechvodam. All the other kings, they gather groups and groups in their honor. And I... Va'ani yodai muluchlachos bedam. My hands are dirty with the blood. V'shfir v'sholya kedei latar isha labayla. I'm dealing with nida questions. So women come with questions. Some of them are rachmana litzlan, stillborns or fetuses. So the question is the woman permitted to razmet? Does she have to immerse in the mikvah? Does she not? David HaMelech was not just a political leader. He wasn't just a melech. He was a posik. So he says, Ribono Shalom, look. The other kings, people who are monarchs, they sit around, fancy clothes, twiddling their thumbs in their military jackets. And I'm busy with my sleeves rolled up, dealing with difficult questions, getting my hands dirty. Why? So that I can bring a couple together. The people should get along with each other. And he says that this is the pshat of why David HaMelech says, I'm a chassid. A chassid is somebody who cares about other people. He's worried about other people. He's working for other people. He says a long pshat here, a melech shemachal kvoda, which we're not going to get into, so just turn the page. Umehai taima, second paragraph right here. For this reason, nami, therefore also. Kinu talmidei ha-Baal Shem Tov esatzman chassidim. That's why the students of the Baal Shem HaKadosh call themselves chassidim. Since the main point of the way, Haya Laharbos Shalom Vereos Fa'avas Yisrael. The main goal of the Baal Shem was to bring people together, to bring harmony, to bring love among Jews. That's why, you know, there are some, based on the Alter Rebbe, one of the descendants of the teachings of the Baal Shem HaKadosh, one of the early Hasidic masters, to say when they start davening in the morning, I don't know if anybody ever does this or heard this, to say, I'm a Kabbalah myself, the mitzvah of V'yahavta l'reicha kamocha. It's what the Alter Rebbe, I think Chabadniks do this, many others, you've heard of this practice. So the Kleisberger says, you know why they're called Chassidim, why we're called Chassidim? Because the goal of a Chassid is to help people become friends, to get together, Shevas Achim. Maybe, he doesn't say this, but maybe to drink a L'chaim together, to have a Niggin together, to have a shoulder to cry on. He says that's what it means to be a Chassid. And then he goes on to explain that's Marbim Sholom Ba'olam. It's the antithesis of the machlokas of this week's parasha of Korach Va'adaso. So the Kleisenberger was on fire about chassidus, about taking care of people, about being machazik them, about making them feel good, even at his own expense. There was a woman who, it's a long story, who wrote an article, one of many articles, because she moved to Kiryat Sanz, and she's an author, and she started writing articles. She wrote a beautiful article about the second wife of the Kleisenberger, about many people. So she interviewed some survivors. So there was a woman she interviewed. Her name was Edith Cohn. So Edith Cohn was a girl, a Yesoma, who was in the DP camp on Erev Yom Kippur. And she describes that she came to the Kleisenberger and knocked on the door. And it was not long before Kol Nidre, and the Kleisenberger was about to start making his pre-yantiv hachanos, you know, to really meditate and think and prepare. But this girl, Edith Cohn, says she came to the door, and she knocked on the door, and the Kleisenberger came to say hello to her. And she said, you know, I have no parents, so I have no one to give me a bracha for Yom Kippur. Would you give me a bracha? So the Kleisenberger said, Avada? So he gets a tichel, he puts a tichel on her head, he gives her a bracha. And she feels so good, she goes and tells one of her friends, you know, the Holy Kleisenberger gave me a bracha for Yom Kippur. So of course, what happens? The friend comes, knocks on the door, exactly! And she describes that a few minutes later, there are dozens of girls, orphan girls, lined up, standing outside the door of the Kleisenberger. And he blesses each and every one of them. So he had no time to make achanos for Yom Kippur. But he was so passionate about Ahavas Yisrael and taking care of someone else and making them feel good. That was his avoda. And he did many things, just parenthetically. He didn't just set up yeshivas for boys. He was very active in teaching girls. He wrote a special Shabbos pamphlet. Shabbos like a alon, you know, a Dvar Torah parasha sheet for girls. He also gave a weekly shir for girls from behind the mechitza. He had all the girls sitting there. He sat behind the mechitza to give them a special shir. To give them chizuk. It's just like in one of the books, Esther Farbstein says that you cannot fathom how it is possible all the things that this one man did in the course of a day. And yet he did, because he was mamish. He was on fire. But the way that he inspired people, the way that he cared about them, the help that he gave them, the chizuk that he gave them. This is a newer book by Esther Farbstein. It's called Beseser HaMadrega. I do not think it's been translated. This is about Hungarian Jews specifically. So there's a little quote here from one of the survivors. His name is Shraga Ferdalski. He says that the Kleisenberger was a ner yachid, was a singular candle, a singular light, in the depths, the darkness of the concentration camp. He shone around him tremendous strength. And he gave us strength and belief. He was our source of chizuk, this man says, this survivor says. Who hit balate behis naaguso hamofsis hageya besor Yehudi. He expressed and he manifested this tremendous pride of being a Jew, and he raised everybody else up with him. He was so passionate. He was so on fire. Last two ha'aros, he was passionate about the Ribono Shel Olam, and it's described in many of these different works how he would have many conversations with the Ribono Shel Olam. You should know, and I've heard some of these, and I could send them to you also if you want afterwards. I don't know how they got my email. Maybe my brother sent it to them. There's a group of Kloisenbergers who, every once in a while before Yontif, they send out videos of the Kloisenberger. Some of them are just audio clips, you know, with a picture of him with the words. You hear him in the middle of davening starting to talk about, you know, something else. He starts the Ribono Shel Olam, they're in the middle of davening something. I forget, one time it was Hoshanos, another time it was something, Megillah, and he starts just talking to the Ribono Shel Olam. Take care of the children, your children need you. Oh, there's so much. He just goes on and on. There's an interesting halachic question, if you're even allowed to do this, but if you're on the Kloisenberger's level, because he was mamish so close with the Ribono Shel Olam. It describes in one of the books that he, when he arrived in Auschwitz, he approached a group of Hungarian Bachrim, and he said to them, Bachrim, do you feel God here? Do you feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu here? He's just making sure that we all feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu even here, and how he lived with that awareness. Probably one of the most famous stories that maybe some of you have heard about the Kloisenberger and his close relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam is about that first Kol Nidre in the DP camp. I don't know if any of you are familiar with this. It's a somewhat more famous story that the Kloisenberger, when it came time during Mairiv to lead the vidui, the confession, instead of saying, "Oh Shamnu," he said, "Oh Shamnu? Did we steal? Gazalnu? Bagadnu? Did anybody do that?" He went through each one. He says, "No, the truth is, Gazalnu, yes. One time, I was lying." You ready? "I was lying in the barracks, and my skin got pinched in the boards, and it ripped, and I moaned, and I woke someone up. So yes, I stole the sleep." Okay, we'll put that aside, he says. He goes through all the Ashamnus. Did anybody do that? Al-Chait? He says, Lashon Hara. Did anybody here say Lashon Hara in the last 5 years? Who had time to say Lashon Hara? Who could even think of saying Lashon Hara? And he goes one by one, and he closed the machzor. And then he says to Ribono Shel Olam, says it's true. We didn't do any of these things. But maybe there was one thing. We sinned, quote, in our faith and trust in our Creator. Did we not doubt Hashem out of despair and hopelessness in the camps? When we recited Shema at night, we hoped that it would be our last hamapil, that the end of our suffering would come. How many times did we pray, Master of the Universe, I have no more strength. Take my soul so I will not have to recite Moda Ani anymore. And when the sun rose and we were obligated to thank Hashem for returning my soul with great mercy, we were consumed with anger and rage. When we removed the corpses from the barracks, weren't we jealous of those lucky people who had died? This is how we have sinned. With a lack of faith and trust, we must beat our chests and admit our sins. We must ask the Almighty to restore our faith and trust in Him. Trust in God forever. Trust in Him at all times, nation. Pour your hearts out before Him. And this emuna was also expressed in davening, in the way that the Kloisenberger davened. Now, apparently he had a line that he used to say to the Ribono Shel Olam, Sur Meira va'asei tov. Sur meira, turn away from all the evil that has existed in this world. Va'asei tov. And do for us. And so the Kloisenberger continued davening and davened before, during, and after the war. There's a description in here when the Rebbe was in Moldorf in the forest, that there too he said Kol Nidre. The Rebbe led the Kol Nidre in that moment. It says in the book, Miyom, when he's saying the davening, Miyom Kippurim Ze Ad Yom Kippurim Haba. He had a feeling of hope. His davening was La'ila U'La'ila. It's something that is the theme throughout these different stories, these different works. And that davening, this conversation, it was because he was so passionate about Kadosh Baruch Hu. So even in the Moldor forest, he could scream out, Ad Yom Kippurim Haba Aleinu Latova. Sur Meira Va'asei Tov, he said to the Ribbono Shel Olam. In many of these videos, in these audio clips, he's pleading. He's talking to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Kebena Meschati Lefnei Aviv. He's begging, he's pleading. It's just this... this Eish Tukad, it's this fire that's never consumed. And so, while there are many more things to say about the Kloisenberger, to summarize, we talked about the Kloisenberger's passion, which enabled him to build institutions throughout his entire lifetime, to build homes through marriage, to build mitzvos, to help people, to build a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whether it was through his emuna or through his davening. I think for each one of us, even if we never reach that level, you see the picture on the bibliography, this is right after the war, you look at the face of this tzaddik and you see one individual, and yet you realize that one individual with this much passion can change lives, hundreds, thousands, the whole Jewish people. So even though we're not at that level, but each one of us can think about what aspect of Yiddishkeit can we be passionate about. Right? It's really amazing because the Rebbe was passionate about everything. The Kloisenberger also wrote tshuvas. He wrote tshuvas called Divrei Yatzah, very important responsa. The level of knowledge that he had was amazing. So he was passionate about halacha, he was passionate about chesed, he was passionate about davening, he was passionate about everything. So the question is for us, can we be passionate about something? What is it that we're passionate about? And how do we take that passion and light that and share it with others? If we're passionate about davening, how is that expressed? If we're passionate about learning, how is it expressed? If we're passionate about chesed, and if we're not passionate about anything, we should find something. So hopefully we'll each have an opportunity to find our spark and follow the path of the Kloisenberger, who led us with this model of being passionate, of being on fire. Mamish, the Lapida Eish, Rev Yekusiel Yehuda Halberstam, Zichrono Levracha. His neshama should have an aliyah, Lichten Gan Eden, should be a melech yosher for all of us, and Zchusu Yagan Aleinu.